Right? The last paragraphs on the page. And he's talking here about Judas and his wisdom. And he said, "Where did you learn to speak so well?" And Judas Alpheus says, "On Jesus' mother's knees. As children, Our Lady brought all three of them up." She was the teacher for the two cousins and Jesus. And he said, "I learned it also beside him." Of course, we know that's Jesus. "What lessons," he says, "I learned. What words I heard. Only he can speak better than she. But what she lacks in power, she gains in kindness, and penetrates our heart, all her lessons. Have you ever seen a piece of cloth, the corner of which touches a scented oil? It slowly absorbs the scent, but not the oil. And even if the oil is removed, the scent is still there to say, 'I was there.' She's like that. With her wisdom and grace, she imbued us, coarse pieces of cloth, which later life washed, and her perfume is still within us." Now, Peter says that he would like Jesus to bring his mother here so that she could exert a good influence on them, and also the people, with her wisdom. And Jesus now comes out of the kitchen, holding the hand of a little boy who is eating a piece of bread and with honey on it. And he praises this little one because he wants to be a follower. He wants to learn everything, to preach, cure the sick, children, and tell everyone that the Messiah is here. Now Thomas teases him. He said, "What will you do for Jesus since you're a little rascal?" And he says, "I will love him, and I will do everything, and he will do everything because I love him. If you do that, you will become good too." Now Jesus says, "Thomas, you've just had your lesson." And now he addresses the crowd. He said, "It is said, you shall not bear false witness." He says that a liar is cruel. He kills a reputation with his tongue. He's a murderer because he kills a body, a good name, and the memory of a man. Jesus speaks about those who make false insinuating lies that turn people against an innocent person. He says it's done out of three reasons: hatred, greed, or fear. And he explains, hatred. A good person, Jesus says, does not hate, but forgives. Hatred is a revolt of evil against good. It is the witness, and I'm quoting here, that a lost soul bears of itself. It is the best witness in favor of an innocent person. Now, greed. A liar desires what another person has and can only get it by destroying that person's good name and ruining his family. He forgets to ask himself this question: what will happen if I'm found out? He forgets that God is stronger than Satan and will take vengeance on the lying calumniator. And then fear. It is the most common form of falsehood. When an evil deed has been done, a person will commit slander to protect his name and reputation by blaming it on someone else of whose honesty he's afraid. Now he says, behave properly. Slander, falsehood, puts a heavy burden on a person's mind, and he says, it is made of subjection to the evil spirit, of perpetual fear of being found out, and of the necessity of remembering the lie, and all the circumstances, details, in which it was told, without contradicting oneself. It is only helped, if it only helped to gain heaven. Instead, it only serves to prepare a place in hell. Now take a person, take the politicians. We've had this in the history of our country now. Okay? They stand before the judge and say, "I'm not guilty." But when they go through all the details, he is guilty, and for serious things. So in other words, in all the details of a person's life and their covering up, They're investing this present president. See, the cover-up. And all that they say, they've got to think back. I said this, and I've got to cover it up. All their life is like a heavy weight on their conscience. This is what Jesus is bringing out. Could this woman have thought of all this again? See, all through these works, I'm pointing out facets to you. How could these people say it is a highly sentimentalized novel? How wrong. They haven't read all the works. Now, Jesus also says, be frank. And here I'm going to quote on page 708, third paragraph from the top. Be frank. How lovely are the lips of a man who does not know falsehood. He may be poor, coarse, unknown. He is he? But he is still a king because he is sincere. And sincerity is more regal than gold and diadems and elevates one above the crowds more than a throne and procures a great court of good people, a greater court of good people than a monarch has. Intimacy with a sincere man gives safety and comfort. Now he adds, a friendship with an insincere person or even being in their company leaves one with a sense of uneasiness. When a lie is revealed, it always leaves one with a nagging suspicion about that person's truthfulness. Anything they tell you after that, you're always asking yourself, are they telling me the truth? Can I trust them? In other words, to give up your credibility is one of the most precious things you can lose. Nobody will believe you. He also says, be simple. And here again I will quote. It's a paragraph below that. Be simple like God and a child. Be truthful every moment of your lives. Do what you want to be considered good. Do you want to be considered good? Be truly so. Even if a scandalmonger should wish to speak evil of you, 100 good people will say, no, it is not true. He's good. His deeds speak of him. Or we would say speak for themselves. So he tells the people that the sin of falsehood is as old as the world, and God's judgment on those who lie is unchanged. And that's on page 709. I'll quote this. I say, have only one language. May your yes be always yes, and your no always no. You remember that in the gospel?
Yes.
See, notice how all through this work the gospels are quoted. Also before mighty ones and tyrants say that. And you will receive great reward in heaven for it. I say to you, be spontaneous, like a child who by instinct goes toward him whom he perceives to be good without seeking anything but goodness. And he says what his own goodness makes him think, without considering whether he says too much and whether he may be reproached for it. If I may insert a little joke in here. And a preschooler, the priest, was trying to put the children at ease. One little boy comes up to him, looks at me, and says, you look funny. White collar, black shirt. And he explains, well, priests dress that way, like police have a uniform, and soldiers have a uniform. So he looks at the collar, he says, you got a boo-boo there? Thinking it might be a Band-Aid, you know.
Yes.
So he takes the collar out, it's an insert, he turns it around, shows him the manufacturer's name. And he says, can you read this? 3 years old. He can't read, but he says, yes. And he says, what does it say? It kills fleas and ticks for 5 weeks. Now, I never thought I was wearing a dog collar.
You're free.
Now, there's a little one speaking as he thinks, right? Out of the mouths of children. Mm-hmm. Yes. So now we begin the next chapter. Jesus says, you shall not covet your neighbor's goods. Now I'm going to quote the verse lines there. God gives everybody what is necessary. That is the truth. What is necessary to man? Pomp, a large number of servants, countless fields, banquets lasting from sunset to dawn? No. All that is necessary to man is a roof, a loaf of bread, a garment, the indispensable to live. Look around yourselves. Who are the happiest and the healthiest? Who enjoys a healthy, tranquil old age? Fast-living people? That applies today especially. People drive in the fast lane. And Jesus says, no. Those who live and work honestly and wish honest things, they are not poisoned by lust, and thus they are strong. They are not intoxicated by orgies, and are thus agile. They are not consumed by the poison of jealousy, and are thus cheerful. Who instead craves to possess more and more, kills his own peace, and has no joy, grows old precociously, consumed by envy and abuse. Well, let's look at that word envy. Envy is avarice, the desire to possess other people's property. It separates man from God, unites him to Satan. Lucifer was the first one to envy. He envied God, wanted to be God. Adam and Eve envied God's knowledge. Cain envied Abel's friendship with God. The whole history of God's people is filled with the envy of individuals who brought their country to ruin. And Jesus adds this thought: the sins of individuals accumulate and bring disasters on their country, exactly as grains of sand piling up over the centuries cause landslides that destroy villages and their inhabitants. Apply that today, that it fits exactly. The national sin of abortion accumulates punishment. Think of the terrible sins of abortion and the punishment that God will visit upon that country and the people who vote for the man who promotes it. Jesus reminds them that he wants his people to be simple and trustful like little children. He then asks them to imitate the simplicity and the trustfulness of the birds. They're free from desires and trust in God's in God to bring them all they need, and God does not fail them. He goes into a lot of detail there. It makes good reading, but I need to digest in order to complete our conferences today. So far, any question? What you notice here, first of all, is morality. Mm-hmm. It's very precise. I have been trained and studied theology and morals. How could this woman in bed 28 years give such precision to immoral thoughts without, what, scholars to help her, whatever? Theologians are amazed at the knowledge here. It's not her then. See?
Truth. You have to suffer for it sometimes. And yet, where does the justice come in this misunderstanding of truth, approaching its people, you know? We have no problems except people.
Well, when justice is offended, the rights of people.
Yes.
Then the truth of what was done has to be brought out and brought out in court.
Oh.
Okay?
It's not that serious.
And
you just misunderstand.
Well, between relationships that are...
breaking friendships.
Yes. Well, we have to be truthful to one another.
Yes.
But there, a lot of wisdom is involved. Sometimes it's better for a person not to know certain things.
Yes, I agree.
Like the future. God is truthful, but he will not tell us the future. We have no right to ask for it.
That's right.
Because we don't have the grace for what's going to happen tomorrow or even an hour from now. We don't have that grace.
Okay.
All you have is the grace to listen to me. If you're falling asleep, you're not using the grace.
No, then you pray that the misunderstanding in truth is brought out or left alone. Which?
Say that again.
The misunderstanding, when it's brought out in truth, is it better to bring it out or leave it alone?
To patch up a friendship, you have to be honest with one another.
Okay.
An apology may be needed, and oftentimes it's the answer. Be humble.
Yes.
And
right.
Jesus himself extends himself when he doesn't have to.
Okay.
He gives an example.
All right.
Like a person who has hurt another, I'm not going to talk until they call me first.
Oh.
Well, Jesus wasn't that way.
No.
And so we sometimes have to step out while it looks like we're too eager. Love is behind that. And love is the one word in Christianity that oversees everything.
Okay.
Covers everything. Okay?
And
love of neighbor. Love of God and neighbor.
And humbly you can apologize.
Yes. And you'll feel better too.
I do.
There'll be, in other words, there'll be a special grace for that.
Thank you.
Let us move on now to the next chapter. Jesus at Clearwater, he's closing up his ministry there. He's talking to this is 712. He's talking to the people about the time when Judas Maccabeus reconquered Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple after destroying the pagan altars and temples. And he says that every word in the history of Israel, that the chosen people, has a spiritual meaning. That means what you read in the Old Testament, that God is his people, has a meaning for us. The life of Israel is a teaching, not only for our earthly days, but also for the conquest of the eternal days. He applies this to the need for each person to remove the false gods from their life. Now, what are the false gods? Not statues. Seven capital sins. Sensuality, gold, pride, he mentions three. These altars to false gods must be destroyed, and God must take their place. He says that the Ten Commandments are the columns or pillars of the temple of the soul. On top of these columns is the holiest precept, love your God, love your neighbor. This is the crown of the temple of the soul and the glory of God. And he goes on to develop that. On 7:13, the last paragraph. Without love, one could not keep the 10 rules, meaning the commandments, and the columns would fall, all of them, or some, and the temple would crash, all of it or part. But it would always be a ruin and no longer suitable to receive the Most Holy. Do what I told you. Knock down the three lusts. Be sincere in giving a name to your vices, as God is sincere in saying to you, do not do this or that. It is useless subtilizing forms Whoever loves something more than he loves God, whatever that love may be, is an idolater. Whoever invokes God, professing himself his servant, and then does not obey him, is a rebel. Whoever, out of greed, works on the Sabbath, is a distrustful, presumptuous desecrator. Whoever refuses to help his parents, advancing pretexts, even if he says that they are works given to God, is one who is hated by God, who put fathers and mothers as his image on the earth. Whoever kills is always a murderer. Whoever fornicates is always lustful. Whoever steals is always a thief. Whoever lies is always vile. And whoever covets what is not his is always a greedy, loathsome glutton. Whoever desecrates a nuptial bed is always filthy. Now, the Maccabees, after they had purify the temple, and Jesus applies this to our soul. In other words, as they tore down the altars and they purified the original temple. Now, Jesus says, the temple of the soul is purified by humble and sincere repentance. God forgives all sins, no matter how many, if the sinner is really repentant. Now, he takes the words from the book of Maccabees and he takes certain phrases. He says the Maccabees then erected another altar in the temple of, and he says, applying it to ourselves now, in the temple of the soul, there can be only one altar, God's. Either God or the idol. That is our choice. And the next words of the Maccabees of what they did is, and they lit the fire with flint and tinder. Now, Jesus gives a spiritual meaning there. The tinder is our desire to cancel even the memory of our sin in God's heart for the rest of our life. The fire that is lit is love. By our love for our Heavenly Father, we now want to please and console Him. Jesus indicates that there is a new altar among them from which streams of light and forgiveness flow, which cure, reinvigorate. He's like the priest that will unite his voice with theirs in seeking their forgiveness. And he offers a beautiful prayer, which we are going to read now, 7:15. From this deep abyss where I, mankind, have fallen, I cry to you, Lord, listen to the voice of him who looks at himself and sighs, and do not close your ears to my words. O God, I am horrified at seeing myself. I am horrible in my own eyes. And what shall I be in your eyes? Do not look at my faults, O Lord. Otherwise, I will not be able to withstand your presence. But have mercy on me, because you said, I am mercy, and I believe in your word. My soul, wounded and depressed, confides in you, in your promises, and from dawn till dusk, from my youth till my old age, I will hope in you. He also quotes Psalm 50 of David, seeking forgiveness for his sins after he had committed the adultery with Bathsheba. And then he says, forget the past. Now, this is a good maxim. Forget the past, smile at the future. Do not worry about the mire, meaning mud. Look at the stars. Do not say, I am darkness. Say, God is light. These words were also addressed to the veiled woman, giving her hope and consolation. For those that are here today, they may not know, while he was in the clear water, always on the edge of the crowd, there was a veiled woman, which eventually found out was a prostitute. And she was being converted, but she was being very hidden. But they were aware of it. After hearing these words, she walks away with a light and agile step. She seems to have wings as the wind reaches around her mantle. Now Peter asks Jesus what they're to do for the Feast of Lights that will be celebrated soon, and they're away from home. That's a special feast that the Jews celebrated, and usually they're at home. And Jesus says they're going to celebrate it where they are. Now, Peter compares himself with the other disciples, and he admits that he seems to be the least gifted, only capable of catching fish and knowing how to sail a boat. But Jesus says otherwise, and here we have Jesus' estimate of Peter's character. When it's all put together, these books, when we celebrate the Feast of the Apostles, would be a beautiful homily, the way it's drawn out. Now, here's what Jesus says in the middle of the page. He lays his hand on his shoulder and shakes him, looking at him with loving admiration, a true admiration of such sincerity, and he says, do you not think that is a lot, meaning taking care of fish and boats? Simon Peter, you have what is necessary to be my stone. Nothing to be added, nothing to be taken away. You will be the eternal navigator. He's using nautical terms now. Mm-hmm. Simon, and you will say to who comes after you, watch the pole star, that is Jesus. A firm hand on the rudder, strength, courage, firmness, carefulness, hard work, without sparing oneself, an eye on everything, capable of standing up also on rough seas. With regard to being silent, well, the fish did not teach you that. He had a very loose tongue, and he was quick to utter words that he was sorry for having said. He also, Peter asks if Jesus will grant him a son, and Jesus says no. My dear Peter, you will not have one son, but 1,000, 10,000 sons, and in every country. You will be a fisher of men. You will give them eternal life, and you will find a home, find them in heaven, and bring them to me, saying, here are the children of your Peter, and I want them to be where I am. While he shed tears at not having a son of his own, he also has joyful tears over the promise of bringing many to Jesus. Now Jesus shows Peter a precious golden ring. He tells Peter that a stone fell at his feet while Jesus was praying under a tree, and a little parchment was attached to it. When he opened it up, there was one word written on it, charity. It was from the veiled woman. He asks Peter to go and take it to the hotel keeper and sell it so that he can get the money to buy food and whatever needed for them and for the poor. And now the next chapter, 7:19, Jesus leaves Clearwater. He goes towards Bethany. The disciples have cleaned up the place and everything is tidy. There are no people now, and his ministry there is completed. The disciples are doing manual work, making wicker work, fish traps, digging drains for the pools of water to drain from the threshold floor of the field house. And Jesus is in the meadow, tossing breadcrumbs to some sparrows. Now, wouldn't that make a beautiful picture if somebody painted that, you know, and watching the birds picking it up in the air? Now, Andrew joins him. Now, here again is a beautiful part of Andrew. We know very little about him, but in these volumes, he's a very quiet person, but he works quietly, and Jesus praises him for that. So now he joins Jesus, and they have a very consoling conversation, especially for Andrew. Andrew thinks that he is the least of the disciples, and he can do nothing compared to others. Remember what Peter said about him, you can do nothing. And yet he said, you know everything before I do. Peter was kind of annoyed at him. But Jesus makes a prophecy for Andrew. He tells him that he will one day be perfectly identical to his brother Peter at the end of his mission on earth. He also tells Andrew that he too works with much profit for Jesus. He says, I am the only one to realize that you work noiselessly, but more deeply than all the others. Now remember, of course, he's God. And whatever the apostles are doing, he's aware of that. And Judas too. Jesus now tells Andrew what he does not want his priests to become. In other words, ministers who are nothing but noise and exterior gestures, false shepherds like movie actors. He says, are they priests? No, they are M-I-M-E-R-S. How do you pronounce that? Mimers? Mimers? But we say mimic.
Yeah.
Why don't we say mimers?
Because this is without words. They act without words.
No, I'm talking about the pronunciation. So whichever words you prefer, mimers or mimers. You know, these are people who mimic people.
That's
and
right.
For comedy. He said, they're nothing else. Gestures do not make the priest, neither does the cassock, neither worldly knowledge, nor mighty worldly relations make the priest. Now he adds something here on 7:21. Top of the page. He said, my priest is completely spiritual. That is how I dream him. That is what my holy priest will be like. The priest has neither the voice nor the attitude of the stage player. It is insubstantial because it is spiritual, and therefore it cannot wear peplum or masks. It is what it is, spirit, fire, light, love. It speaks of the spirits, to the spirits. It speaks with the chastity of eyes, of gestures, of words, of deeds. Man looks and he sees a fellow creature, but what does he see above and beyond the flesh? Something that makes him slow down his hurried steps, that make him meditate and conclude, this man, who is like me, has only appearance of man. He has the soul of an angel. If he is a misbeliever, he concludes, because of him, I believe that there is a God in a heaven. And if he is lustful, he says, this fellow creature of mine has heavenly eyes. I will restrain my sensuality so that I may not desecrate them. And if he is a miser, he decides, because of the instance of this man who is not attached to riches, I will stop being a miser. And if he is a man quick to anger, or a cruel fellow in front of a gentle person, he will become more quiet and calm. That is what a holy priest will be able to do. And believe me, amongst the holy priests, there will always be some ready to die for the love of God and of their neighbor. And they will do it quietly, after practicing perfection throughout their lives, also very quietly, that the world would not even notice them. But if the whole world does not become utter lewdness and idolatry, it will be through those heroes of silence and loyal activity. And their smiles will be like yours, pure and timid, because there will always be some Andrews. They will exist through the grace of God and for the fortune of the world. How about that? Could that woman have written all that? Again, see, I keep throwing this out to you because there are articles being written that is highly sentimentalized novel. These people who do that have not read these works.
Excuse me. Could it be that they didn't experience any of this? That when they read these words, they can't fathom the depthness?
No. I have not met one person read all four or five volumes that is critical.
Wow.
You just can't do that. Now, after these words of Jesus, Andrew says he does not deserve such praise. But Jesus indicates he knows how Andrew has been assisting the veiled woman while others were either sleeping or busy. But Jesus knew, and he tells Andrew that he was praying while Andrew was ministering to the poor sinful woman. Again, here's another facet of Jesus' life. It's not in the gospel. But isn't that true? As God, he was aware of what everything was going on. And when he didn't keep a closed eye, he was praying for Andrew's ministry to be graced and blessed. Now Jesus and Andrew return to the field house, where they meet with the other three disciples, Simon Zealot, Thomas, and Judas Iscariot. They're loaded with sacks of goods and a letter, the three, and Jesus' mother, a letter from her. And Jesus reads it with a smile. Our Lady sends greetings from all the wives and the family of the disciples with the clothing and food that they prepared for them for the coming winter. And now Our Lady speaks to Jesus in the letter, and I'm going to read part of that on page 723. The middle of the page. Now, my beloved son, I think that for almost a year you have not been entirely mine, and I seem to have gone back to the time when I knew that you were already here, because I felt your little heart beating within my womb. But I could also say that you were not yet here, because you were separated from me by a barrier which prevented me from caressing your beloved body, and I could only adore your spirit, O my dear Son and adorable God. Also now I know that you are here, and that your heart beats with mine, never separated from me, even if we are not together. But I cannot caress, hear, serve, and venerate you, the Messiah of the Lord, and his poor maid. How about words like that?
Mm-hmm.
They're just so beautiful, and they match Our Lady as we would want her to be. Could this woman have done all that? Keep asking yourself. And then you ask these people, how can they be so blind? So Mary also mentions that Joseph of Alphaeus was threatened when he went to Jerusalem on business because of his relationship to Jesus, and he was threatened by the Pharisees. And she closes with this writing. I'd like to add something here And I want to add what Our Lady, what is being said here too. Our Lady is still writing, and I should have had this already said before this. Our Lady says, "This will be the first time that I will say to myself, my child is a year older today, and I have not my child with me." Notice the Feast of Lights. All the families sit together. "And I will be sadder than your first birthday at Maitreya. But you are fulfilling your mission, and I mine, and we are both doing the will of the Father, and we are acting for the glory of God." That wipes all tears, and dear son, I know what you are doing from what I am told. As the waves carry the voice of the open sea as far as the solitary enclosed gulf, so the echo of your holy work for the glory of God reaches our quiet little house, and your mother rejoices and trembles, because if they all speak of you, not everyone expresses the same hearty feelings. Friends and people you have helped come to me and say, 'Blessed be the son of your womb.' And also your enemies come to pierce my heart, saying, 'Anathema on him.'" That again did we know, not from the Gospels. See? Now Judas and Simon, I should be finished the letter. I think that's more like it. At the bottom, page 724, she says, "Son, my adored and holy son, I am keeping my arms raised as Moses did on the hilltop, praying for you in your battle against the enemies of God and yours, my Jesus, whom the world does not love. Leah of Isaac died here, and I was very sorry because she was always a good friend of mine. But my greatest sorrow is that you are far away and not loved by people. I bless you, my son, and as I give you peace and blessing, I ask you to give yours to Mother." Well, Judas and Simon Zealot now break the bad news that the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin had been planning to catch Jesus in a trap because of what has happened to their Pharisee Doris, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And their fear of him and hatred are making them set traps. Judas also says, this is Judas Iscariot now, also says that the Pharisees know everything about all of them and their activities. The disciples urge Jesus not to go to Jerusalem, and Jesus agrees. They now open all the sacks, share the clothing and food that has been prepared for them. But Jesus is quiet and sad as he reads his mother's letter over and over again. Now, how about something like that? Is he like any one of us? Didn't Paul say he's like us in every way except sin? Wouldn't you, if you had a son away and you read it over and over again, to read it, kind of embedded in your heart? So, Jesus now tells the disciples to pack up and leave in the dead of night for a town called Doko, and then they would go on to Bethany. And the reason was that there's a woman dying in that town and is waiting to be cured by him. Any question? Not a year old, but 1 year where they were visiting at that time. That's not in the Gospel either. But there's no explanation given, so we simply have to leave that. All right, in the next chapter now, Jesus is in this town, and he comes to the family where this woman has cancer. That's 7:27. He's entering the town of Doko on a dull winter morning. When he comes to the house, he finds there are six children and the grandmother waiting for him. The sick person, woman, her name is Jerusa, has had three sets of twins. And her breasts have been so tortured that she received cancer. Now, Jesus puts his hand on her breast, and as soon as he does, the pain leaves, and the woman is filled with joy. She calls all her children, wants them to share the miracle. And Jesus decides to stay at this house with his disciples, at least for a meal. And he asks Judas Iscariot to go and buy food for the poor family, enough for a few days. And Judas now tells Jesus that he will buy the food with his own money. Now here's another good side of Judas. We need to balance this, okay? And he says that he had some gold that he had reserved for the temple, but now he will not give it to the greedy people there. And Jesus is pleased with his decision. In the next chapter, then, we have Jesus in the house of Simon Zealot. Page 730. He arrives in Bethany on a bright, sunny December day. Lazarus' house is beautiful, but it's one of many other beautiful homes of rich people who want to live near their property. A servant who has been at the edge of the land runs to tell Lazarus of Jesus' arrival. And when Jesus sees Lazarus, they run to meet each other, and he kisses Lazarus on his cheek. He's disappointed, that's Lazarus, that Jesus is not staying at his home. He thinks that it's because Mary Magdalene is in Bethany, and Jesus is avoiding her. And he says that the devil has driven her here just today. But Jesus says, why say the devil drove her here, and why not her angel by God's order? And that's what really is the fact. In other words, Jesus intended that she should be there to hear what he was going to say. And he says, even if she were not here, I would have come to Simon Zealot's home anyhow. So he also adds that Lazarus has called him to Bethany because the Pharisees have been planning to ambush him at the Clearwater. So he feels safe near Lazarus, but he will be more free from the spying of the Pharisees by staying at Simon's home. The reason is, the Pharisees believed that whoever was a Pharisee, they have free entrance to all their homes. Therefore, Lazarus' father, a Pharisee, and the property belonged to his father. Therefore, they could invade his house at any time, but not Simon Zealot. Now, Martha comes